This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kelms. With me is our history doctor, Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
Role of the Supreme Court became a center of political controversy earlier this year. Taking a look at the history behind the battle between the chief executive and the Supreme Court is our history doctor. Help me out here.
Well, when the media has some presentism, it's one thing. It's a little more disturbing when a person who has defined himself as a constitutional law scholar makes a statement like this. Ultimately, I'm confident that the Supreme Court will not take what would be an unprecedented, extraordinary step of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of a democratically elected Congress.
That's a very strong statement.
Yes, it is. And President Obama is marking his territory against what he sees as a Supreme Court that is not cooperating with the executive. It comes on the heels of 2 years ago when he made statements that drew the ire of the court itself during the State of the Union address. You know, in many ways, this is politics by other means. But the words from the president were strong and a little disconcerting because to say it is unprecedented for the court to review cases and overturn them is ignoring one of the fundamentals of our constitutional system. He's also falling in line with previous chief executives that have been frustrated with the court. They would be quick to say one party's activist judge is another party's scholarly thinker.
It depends on whether that court is agreeing with you at that time, I suppose.
Exactly. Now, the president's press secretary tried to clarify, saying that President Obama was using legal shorthand and that the president was not clearly understood by some people. I think I clearly understood the quote. When his own teachers at Harvard Law say that they think he may have misspoke, it will eventually lead the president to restate his position. He will then come back to saying that this would be the first time in decades to strike down legislation related to the economy. The quote again, "We have not seen a court overturn a law that was passed by Congress on economic issue like health care, as I think most people would consider commerce. A law like that has not been overturned since Lochner. So we're going back to the 30s, pre-New Deal."
Does that hold up, that
statement? Well, no. And once again, we're seeing the president be more like the media that we've talked in the past. First of all, within that walk back, the New Deal obviously was in the 1930s. Pre-New Deal is 1932. Frankly, there were significant parts of the New Deal that the court indeed did strike down during the early phases, including ones that touched with the Commerce Clause, and almost all were some kind of economic issue. For example, mortgage relief to farmers went down unanimously before the court in 1935, along with the National Industrial Recovery Act. Roosevelt had his own outburst like that, saying that the court was, quote, horse and buggy with its definition of interstate commerce.
That's pretty strong.
He lost the next year the Agricultural Adjustment Act, one of the original 100 days pieces of New Deal legislation, as that was invalidated by the court. Smaller cases since have been overturned that were attempts to extend the Commerce Clause, notably gun possession near schools and domestic violence. And the Interstate Commerce Clause each time was found to be not that broad. So in a political frustration, we have a fairly bad misstep.
So did President Roosevelt's frustration with all this, did this lead to his attempts to, as they say, pack the court?
Yes. So in a kind of comparison of frustrated chief executives, under the guise of helping the aging court members, Franklin Roosevelt exploited the ultimate constitutional loophole with a plan to appoint judges who would more than likely vote his way. For every Supreme Court justice over the age of 70, he would appoint an additional justice, up to six of them, as well as more lower court justices to help the efficiency of the Supreme Court. His argument being, these gentlemen are old, and they haven't retired, and there's no way to make them retire, but we can certainly help them pick up the pace of their work by giving them a younger justice to work with.
And you know what? I'd be happy to be the president that appoints them.
Exactly. I'm only helping. Sounds a lot like the frustration that Roosevelt was feeling initially was that he had Social Security passed in 35, headed likely to Supreme Court review in 37 or 38, and with his overwhelming election in 37, he decided to take the court on directly, instructing his Attorney General Homer Cummings to come up with this idea to create a court majority. They first thought about amending the Constitution and then sort of come to the realization in that loophole I mentioned. The loophole in the Constitution on the Supreme Court is that there's no definition of how many Supreme Court justices should be there.
Yeah, you can have.
So he could say, I want 15. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was basically saying. I'm going to have 15 Supreme Court justices. I'll keep the 9 that I had and port, well, you know, we'll just add a few more. FDR took to the radio to explain why he wanted to do this. Reading the transcript from this little fireside chat is a little chilling today. Instead of speaking of checks and balances, the federal government, in FDR's definition, was a three-horse team lashed to do the people's work.
To do it together, lockstep?
Exactly, and this is how he said it. Two of the horses, the Congress and the executive, are pulling in unison today. The third is not. So Obama and FDR share that while they both would agree in their talks that Marbury versus Madison was legitimate law of the land, that the Supreme Court does have the right to review legislation, they both in their respective times will accuse the court of being activist, to use our present term, mm-hmm. or as FDR said it, acting not as a judicial body, but as a policymaking body. How many Republican senators have you heard say that same thing?
You bet.
This is the quote, though, in the fireside chat that really kind of gives you the sense of both how far FDR's gone and how far he's willing to go. We have, therefore, reached a point as a nation where we must take action to save the Constitution from the court and the court from itself. We must find a way to take an appeal from the Supreme Court to the Constitution itself. We want a Supreme Court which will do justice under the Constitution and not over it.
Did he have success?
No, he did not, because that line and several others within the fireside chat really scared many members of Congress, both sides of the party. Mm-hmm. This will fail as legislation because both parties will come together. Remember, the Republicans are at epic lows in both houses. Yet this is a bill that when it is introduced, FDR cannot get the House to put forward. He has to arm twist senators to get it moving. So it's headed toward defeat. Yet at the same time, it worked. Journalists look back today on the sudden change in Justice Owen Roberts, who began to vote to uphold New Deal plans after the proposal became known. He is called the switch in time that saved 9. Mm-hmm. So 5-4 votes went from going against Roosevelt to going for Roosevelt. And the Judiciary Reorganization Bill of 37 went down to defeat. I mean, even his own vice president, John Nance, literally held his nose in the Senate and gestured his thumb down when asked about this bill.
I want to ask you a little bit more about key cases here, but this explains why someone who may feel on one side when the California Supreme Court strikes down Prop 9, say you champion that decision because you think, yes, they struck something down unconstitutional, or you're angry because it was something that was properly elected, then we'll take the exact opposite stance on what they hope the Supreme Court does with the health care.
Exactly. You know, the key cases as you're looking back over time are that 1803 landmark case, Marbury versus Madison, which established the ability of the court to review. Our current attorney general has made it very clear that in his mind that is beyond dispute. But it wouldn't be long after 1803 that another president, Andrew Jackson, would disagree with the court. And when it ruled in Worcester versus Georgia, the court laid the groundwork for today's tribal nations, but at the same time infuriated Jackson, who proclaimed that the Supreme Court Justice, John Marshall, has made his decision. Let him go enforce it.
Well, but that's a case that's over 200 years old. Does that?
There are, but you sort of danced around it. But if you look in just our recent past, Brown versus Board of Education, 1957, mm-hmm. is overturning the actions of elected mm-hmm. officials. Roe v. Wade, 1973, overturning the decisions of elected officials. So one has to be careful when using President Obama's phrase of overturning a law that was passed by a strong majority of the democratically elected Congresses. You know, these were state cases, so that you say Congress is plural. But, you know, I think many of the same folks that would be concerned about today's Supreme Court would certainly have qualms about Roe v. Wade or Brown versus Board going against and being upheld because, well, after all, it was strong majorities of these democratically elected houses, legislatures, Congresses that established the laws on abortion and segregation.
Right. Well, until our conversations are declared unconstitutional,
we're history.